It's the Wisconsin Idea edition of To the Best of Our Knowledge, recorded in front of a live audience in Madison. And I want to introduce you to our next guest. Reverend Alex G. grew up in the shadow of the UW campus in Madison. As a boy, he had a paper route, he went to Cub Scouts, he graduated from high school and later from the university, and today he's one of the city's senior ministers, pastor of his own church and a well-known community leader. And yet, like many Black men, he has been the victim of racial profiling right here in his own hometown. He's been pulled over and stopped by police more than once, including in the parking lot of his own church. So 2 years ago, Alex wrote an electrifying column for a local paper. It's called Justified Anger. And in it, he challenged his own city, Madison, to wake up to the kind of everyday realities of racism and classism that a lot of people don't see because they don't have to. So, how can we talk about the dream of the Wisconsin idea with walls of institutional racism still keeping people out? Here's Charles Monroe Kane talking on stage with Reverend Alex G.
I want to back up before we get into some things that you're doing now. And I have a different question for you because we're Facebook friends and I was looking at this on Facebook with you. Your mom moved here in 1970. Why did she move here?
My mother had a childhood friend who moved to Madison to return to college. At the time, there was a program that was called, the five-year program. I believe Mrs. Ruth Doyle began this on campus. And my mom came and toured the campus, loved it. She saw the lake, saw the grass, and students going to school barefoot. And she loved it. And she packed us up from the west side of Chicago and moved us to Madison in 1970 to begin studying at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And my mother was a high school dropout. She was in an abusive marriage, was going through a divorce, and moved to this city to attend this campus because she believed that it would give her and her children a better life.
And she got her master's degree, right? And
she got an undergraduate degree. She started and stopped. She married my stepfather. She took care of her ailing father. I found some of my mother's old transcripts. She was taking 20 and 21 credits a semester. Brilliant woman, still is. I'm having dinner with her after this interview tonight. But she dropped out. When I was a senior, I dared her to come back to school with me. So my mother and I had three classes together at UW-Madison. Yeah, ask me about that sometime. My sister was also here, so the three of us had the same undergraduate advisor, Bill Vandenberg, in the African-American History Department. So my mother beat me by one semester. She graduated in May of 85. I graduated December, but she won a full fellowship to grad school and was actually on the dean's list as a grad student.
Now, of course, you kept going with it. You went on, and not here, but and got your PhD and continued through with education in your mother's footsteps. And you've done many things. You're a pastor of an amazing church here, Fountain of Life. And you also started an organization called Justified Anger, which Ann mentioned. And I wanted to have you share with people why you started that. What was the thing that got that going for you?
Well, I really wasn't trying to start an organization. I already have two full-time jobs. I'm leading, as you mentioned, a real thriving, multi-generational, multi-ethnic, multicultural congregation that's really youthful. I'm the most tenured pastor in this community. Mm-hmm. My nonprofit, Nehemiah, will turn 25 years old next year. I actually left my job here on campus to start this nonprofit, so I wasn't trying to find another job. I think the combination of being pulled over by the police in my church parking lot and showed my ID, and I was 10 feet away from my front door. My white associate pastor was in the parking lot when we pulled up. He was not asked any information. He was actually asked to corroborate my story without showing any identification. I think that coupled with my daughter, who was a National Honor Society student at Madison West, was told not to apply to Wisconsin because she would not get in. And then calling the police because someone had broken into our church 3 weeks before the grand opening. And I called the police, same parking lot, I called the police and described myself. I said, I'm an African-American male. I'm 50 years old. My car is black. It's an Acura. My license plate is. And when I shared that with my non-black friends, they looked at me and they said, I never think to describe myself when I call the police. And I think that's the first thing I think to do. Mm-hmm. So I think, Charles, a combination of all of those things within a short period of time made me take some pen and paper out. And plus, a woman congratulating me for not being an angry black man at downtown Rotary made me call some friends and ask where could I go to begin writing my story. Resonated with people. I started receiving communications from men who are in jail, young boys, mothers telling the stories of their sons, and people started telling me their stories. I couldn't keep up with email. I was getting hundreds of them. My article came out December 18th of 2013. It was the most read story of that week. I got a call from Capital Times within a week that it was the 11th most read story of the year, and it only had a shelf life of 12 days. And so I couldn't keep up with all the emails, and so I just flippantly said, let's have a town hall meeting, and I'll tell you why I wrote the article. 600 people showed up at our church on a Saturday in February, and then the wheels just began to turn. I realized that people did not just want to talk about this. They wanted to know, how can we organize? How can we collaborate? How can we move just beyond analyzing what's happening? So it was really something that I wasn't trying to do, but the momentum has really been carrying me, and it's taken a lot of my time and energy, and not necessarily in a bad way, hostage, but it's something I think about, wrestle with, process probably almost every waking moment of my life.
Let's go back to your daughter for a second. So she was told not to apply to school here. She did, and not only did she apply, then what happened?
She was admitted. Mm-hmm. She was awarded the Powers Knapp Scholarship, so her tuition's paid for all 4 years. She was invited to join the Honors Program here at Wisconsin. She was hired by the City of Madison's Public Library to be an intern. She's interested in library science. She's majoring in creative writing and Italian, and she's thriving. But I couldn't understand why she wouldn't apply. Now, you have to understand, mm-hmm. I have 8 family members with degrees from Wisconsin. We hold 8 degrees, and so when my cousin, who will finish law school next year, and when my daughter graduates, we'll have 10. And so as a former recruiter, in fact, I used to work here. This was 905 University back in the day. And as a recruiter, I always told students, apply at home, apply at home. And it was actually halfway through the tour where she told me, Dad, I didn't apply because my counselor told me I wouldn't get in. Huh. And she later told me that she didn't want me to become involved because she needed a letter of recommendation from the counselor. And she felt that if I went to the school, the counselor would withhold support. So no one talks about the students with 2 parents who are African-American who have what it takes to go to college, telling their parents, don't come to school, I've got this. Because parents come to school and their children aren't doing well. I don't need you to come to school. She also told me that her counselor made that recommendation without looking at her grades. That when she went in to get a letter of recommendation for another UW system school, the counselor, after telling her not to apply to Wisconsin, opened her computer, looked at it, and said, wow, you have really good grades. Why aren't you in the Talented and Gifted program? Why didn't you join the National Honor Society? And so my daughter found this out after applying to Madison.
Now, her grandmother, your mom, went here. That's a big 45-year difference.
It sure is.
How was their experiences different?
This is what's so strange to me. And let me just preface my comment by saying this. I love UW-Madison. You cut me, I bleed red. I love, this campus changed my mother's life. She came here wearing blacks and grays. She'd been beaten up inside, a survivor of abuse. Of course, I'm the product of that very terrible marriage, but she stuck in it for me. This community gave her a gleam in her eyes. She walked Bascom Hill barefoot. She participated in things. She's brilliant. But as a single mom going through a divorce with no high school GED or a diploma, she dropped out freshman year. This campus said, we welcome you. Come on here. You know, we'll give you support for your kids. I don't know if they still do this, but I remember sitting in the old Commerce building, the old business school building. It's Granger. No, it's not Granger. I forget the name. Ingram. I remember watching cartoons there on Saturdays while my mom took exams. So for adult returning students, there were services on campus for kids. I felt welcomed here. I came in through a program that was not for students who were not regularly admissible, but I graduated in 4 years. But the other thing is, I feel that my daughter is looked at with more suspicion as a National Honor Society student than her high school dropout grandmother. And what I can't wrap my mind around it is my mother felt fortunate to be here. My wife and I did. My wife came here on a full-track scholarship. She's a national junior Olympic champion of 400 meters. We met here in school. My daughter calls me from campus and says, Dad, if I did not have a scholarship, I would not be at this campus. She says, I don't believe they want me here. My mother never came home from this campus and said, they don't want me here. And she was a student in 70 and 71, and there was still dust smoldering from the physics building blowing up, and she felt she belonged here. My daughter feels that this campus doesn't want her here 45 years later. That's so hard to wrap my brain around, because of our whole family, she's probably the sharpest student. She's got the best grades, but she's having the worst experience.
So here we are. You're a leader. You have the critique. If I could put a hat on you and say, here you go, reboot the system, reboot the Wisconsin idea, roll up your sleeves. I mean, I'm not saying you have to solve the entire problem now, but what should be done? I mean, should we throw the whole thing out? What should change to make it more inclusive?
Wow, that is a great question. I think the idea needs to be revisited to see if it still earns the right to be called an idea. When I've read of the history, and again, I love this place, but if the idea is that the resources of this campus belongs to the community, how is it that I grow up 2 miles south of here on Park Street and my friends and I don't know this campus? When I started as a freshman, I was chosen to be on a scavenger hunt team because they figured he's from Madison. He knows where all the buildings are. I knew the Memorial Union and Babcock Hall. There's almost an invisible force field, so folks from the community don't come here. Now, I also worked here as a minority recruiter, minority affairs director for the School of Pharmacy, and I was a special assistant to David Ward for minority community relations. I did part of Everett Mitchell's job about 20, 25 years ago. When I worked on this campus, we didn't know what was happening in the community. And so I love the verbiage of the idea, and I even love the way we influenced policy, whether it's workers' comp or whether it's a small business administration or the work of Dr. Steenbach and others in perfecting what happened with vitamin D and ridding rickets. But we're known in this country as ground zero for the treatment of black men. Where's the extension? Where's the university? Where's the knowledge? When I traveled during my doctoral studies to northern part of Thailand, there was a place where, in Udon Thani, where there were impoverished women who wanted to become entrepreneurs. The University of Thailand helped them to perfect technology that allowed them to, rather than selling 2,000 fry or baby tilapia a month, they were selling 1 million a month. They offered the technology. These women started home businesses and became self-sufficient economically. I stood there watching that thinking, what is the technology of the university in my hometown that will help me to address the poverty, the reentry realities, and the dropout rates, the achievement gap of my community? To me, the idea was founded on those principles, and I love those principles. I just want to benefit from those principles. I want to see the idea become to humble the university. When does the community become the teacher? What happens when my ideas clash with the ideas of the university? When will the university sit at the feet of people who roll up their sleeves and deal with issues of reentry, poverty, abuse, sexual assault every day, and ask what we're learning and partnering together? Why is it that I fly to Seattle to be an adjunct professor? Or this past semester, I've driven to Chicago every Monday to teach a graduate course in Chicago. But I'm only a participant, a panelist on issues of diversity here at Madison, but around the country, around the world, I sit with heads of state, Sri Lanka, India, South Africa, asking my opinion, and I don't know what the inside of a classroom looks like on this campus. And so I feel that the idea has got to progress more. I think it's beautiful, I think it's powerful, but I think like many things that happen in our community, it's soft and palatable, and it works. It feels nice on the tongue. But living it out and acting it out is different. And I feel like we've become comfortable. We've taken it for granted. And we are ground zero for the treatment of black men in this country, 2 miles south of here on Park Street. And there is no meaningful relationship. You can't hire someone like a black diversity officer and say, you handle this. The Wisconsin idea was never relegated to a single individual. It was a concept, which means it's not property. So an idea should be able to transcend color and socioeconomics and time. And something's happened that we've either have changed what we think an idea is, or the idea has run its course. But I'm saying I live and work among some of the most depressed, disgruntled, and disenfranchised people I've ever known. And they don't think of the university as the first, second, third, fourth, or fifth place for help. I feel that this place is recognized for its prowess and its experience more around the world than in South Madison neighborhoods.
Amen. Thank you very much.
I hope I don't make your donors mad.
Thank you.
But I want to be part of the solution. Having said all of that, I turned down jobs in Seattle, in New York, in California, because I want to be a part of the solution. But the university cannot approach me when there are murders, when someone spat on, or when someone vandalizes a building. Talk to me about economics. Talk to me about access. Talk to me about leadership development. Talk to me about transformational leadership. But don't just call me up to the big house because there's some problems out in the field and you want me to talk to the rest of the community. I have something to say. I have things that I've written. And if you don't honor your native sons, then by default, by definition, I should say, you've debunked what it means to have an idea. I'm one of Wisconsin's coolest ideas and products. And I don't have any method for giving back.
Thank you very much, man. Thanks.
Reverend Alex G. talking with Charles Monroe Cain. Reverend G. is the head of the Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison, Wisconsin, and founder of the Justified Anger Movement. This is a special episode of To the Best of Our Knowledge, recorded in front of a live audience in Madison, Wisconsin.